This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, August 18, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear responses to the resignation of Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf. We'll hear about Blackwater's legal limbo in the killing of 17 civilians in Iraq. And we'll go to Somalia and hear about the struggle for clean water. All that and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The California Supreme Court today unanimously ruled that doctors cannot use their religious beliefs as a reason to withhold care from gays and lesbians. The decision comes in the case of a lesbian woman who says a private fertility clinic refused to inseminate her. California's high court said that the state's civil rights law barring sexual orientation discrimination extends to medical care. Today in Pristina, the UN and EU missions in Kosovo signed a memo of understanding transferring power in justice, police, and customs matters to the EU. Alexandra Spezov reports from Belgrade, where protests are ongoing.
Besides clarifying Alexei's role in Kosovo during the period of UNMIK reconfiguration, the memorandum covers technical details such as space, cars, and equipment. The plan is opposed by Serbia and Russia and has split the UN Security Council. Serbia has submitted a request for UN General Assembly to debate Kosovo's unilateral declaration of independence and asked the International Court of Justice to weigh in on the matter. Meanwhile, EU staff, including 2,200 member police force, continue to arrive in Kosovo and are expected to be fully operational by September. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Alexandra Spasov in Belgrade.
Asking if freedom for Kosovo, why not for Kashmir? Demonstrators demanded the United Nations recognize the Himalayan region's right to self-determination. Shahnawaz Khan reports from Srinagar.
Chanting pro-freedom and anti-India slogans, some 200,000 Muslims assembled in the city center. They had planned to submit a memorandum to the UN at its military observer office in Srinagar, but police prevented the march. However, smaller groups of protesters, including members of the Kashmir High Court Bar Association, managed to sneak to the UN Military Observer Office and present the memorandum at the gates. The document asked for UN intervention in Kashmir and demanded a referendum, as promised by a UNSC resolution of 1948. The Kashmiri separatists, who organized the rally, said they will ask members of the Kashmiri diaspora, now in the West, to deliver their memo to the international body. Huge pro-freedom demonstrations have returned to Kashmir since controversy over a forest land transfer to a Hindu shrine erupted in June. An anti-India armed insurgency stirred a popular uprising in Indian administered Kashmir in 1989. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar.
Refugees in the Gauteng province of South Africa now must wait until tomorrow to find out the fate of their temporary homes. Six refugee camps housing foreign nationals displaced by xenophobic violence were scheduled to close last Friday, but three refugees and an advocacy group are challenging the closures in South Africa's constitutional court. They say the government has done nothing to help them reintegrate into the communities that turned on them, and they have nowhere to go. Today, the court in Johannesburg recommended mediation and gave representatives for the displaced, the Consortium for Refugees and Migrants in South Africa, and the government until 10 a.m. tomorrow to come up with a solution. The BBC reports that Islamic authorities in one Nigerian city are rounding up sex workers identified by the Red Cross in a census. But a local commissioner says no arrests have been made and authorities were merely supervising against illicit acts. The Red Cross gathered data on female sex workers in an attempt to address the spread of HIV. Several of Nigeria's Muslim-majority northern states introduced Sharia law starting in 2000, resulting in clashes between rival groups. Japanese authorities are seeking international arrest warrants for three Western anti-whaling activists. They are accused of trying to interfere with whaling expeditions in the Antarctic Ocean. The three are members of the Sea Shepherd group, suspected of throwing warning flares into a Japanese whaling vessel last year. Japan claims that the activists, two U.S. citizens and one Briton, rammed a whaling vessel and dumped a foul-smelling rancid butter acid, causing minor injuries to crew members. From WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
News of Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf's resignation has resulted in widespread celebration in Pakistan, stirring some hope of stability in the country. Musharraf came to power in 1999 after a bloodless coup, but has faced constant opposition from a coalition of competing factions since. Pakistan's constitution calls for the chairman of the parliament to assume power for 30 days, after which a new president is to be elected, which may prove to be a tremendous obstacle. The two main opposition leaders are rivals themselves. One is Benazir Bhutto's widower, Asif Ali Zardari. The other is former Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Shahid Mahmood is an internationally syndicated cartoonist. He comments on the upcoming struggle between Sharif and Zardari.
Basically, it's going to be an internal fight. Opposition to Musharraf until now had really bonded the various political parties into a coalition government. And what I see happening is that his departure will probably cause more infighting. These parties have historically been very antagonistic towards each other. Nawaz Sharif and Asif Ali Zardari have basically been at loggerheads throughout their political lives, and I think now, more than ever, it's really going to become accentuated, especially with the fight over the seat of the presidency.
What do you think Musharraf's resignation is going to mean for social movement parties?
That's an interesting question. I think, unfortunately, it's going to remain where it stays, in the sense that Pakistan has not seen any leader actively take a stance on any type of social movement, whether it be education, healthcare, sheltering the poor. These are all very important considerations. In fact, you know, these issues have been taken up not only by NGOs, but private organizations. And I think it really speaks to the nation why we can't do this. And I think the reason being is that the people we elect, when it comes down to democracy, is the fact that these people are feudals or industrialists, and the only thing they really have at heart to fatten their bank accounts and really not provide any level of visionary injection into the public consciousness.
You were a political cartoonist in Pakistan. I wanted to ask you how you think Musharraf's resignation might affect press freedoms in Pakistan.
The problem with Pakistan's freedom of the press really has no bearing necessarily on Musharraf leaving or the democratic process as we may see it taking root again. Musharraf, until the judiciary review and when the judiciary was kicked out, had seen a certain level of liberalism in the press. It was only after the sacking of the judges that measures were really taken to curtail the freedom of the press. And I'll give you an example. When I was cartooning for Newsline, which is a national news magazine that comes out of Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto was at the power. And we saw some of the most brutal ways of shutting down the press and threatening journalists, curtailing all sorts of opposition when it came to looking at her government critically. And this could be seen when she sent police and thugs down to the magazine office, ransacked it, had the editor threatened. The editor had to go out and people like myself, you know what, you really shouldn't be coming in because they've taken offense to the cover that you've drawn or various articles that various journalists had written, and lay low for like 2 or 3 weeks. So the fact that, you know, democracy, or what we so-call, is not really democracy. These are people who think it's their God-given right to rule this country. And until that behavior changes, what we're looking at is not really democracy. Sort of an oligarchy.
Shahid Mahmood is an internationally syndicated cartoonist. Word of Musharraf's resignation has been most welcomed in the streets in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. Students in Peshawar distributed sweets and danced on public roads. And at the madrasas, students and Taliban prayed in mosques. For FSRN's Street Beat, Mudassar Shah compiled public response to Musharraf's resignation.
I don't want to say anything more except that these religious leaders will become stronger than before. Let us see to the future, but I don't think anything will change more.
I think he took a right step by resigning, and I feel he is a man of principles, as we will remember him in good words.
I'm very happy with his resignation. The flour is very expensive and the prices of other commodities may decrease now. The people will get a chance to elect a new president who will take care of the people. People liked him initially, but when he didn't fulfill his commitments, people started to dislike him. I am very optimistic that our new president will care for the poor, and I pray for the safety of my country and for good politicians. Musharraf made our lives hell, and we hope that the next president and government will definitely care for the poor, and the prices of everything will go down.
He was not a politician, he was just a dictator, and no one likes dictator. And here we are very happy that the tenure of the era of dictator is gone. I say because in his tenure there were nothing done in Pakistan. Everything was going down. The economics of Pakistan was just on declining. So when he has left Pakistan, that's very fine. Of course, I've heard that the price of our note is increased as Musharraf has given his resignation. So this may be a good step.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News with Aura Bogado. Starting 1 week from today, be sure to tune in for daily coverage of the Democratic National Convention. We'll be broadcasting from the DNC in Denver. I'll be joined by our Washington editor, Leanne Caldwell, and our correspondents on the streets and inside the convention, bringing you independent perspectives on what's sure to be a historic event. The Justice Department is moving a step closer to prosecuting several Blackwater private security guards involved in the shooting of 17 Iraqi civilians last year. The DOJ recently sent letters to six of the contractors, providing them the opportunity to give their own version of what took place. The information will be reviewed by a grand jury, which will later decide whether to indict. Legal questions remain, however, on whether or not these contractors can be prosecuted at all. FSRN's Karen Miller takes a look at some of the legal wrangling around this case and others like it.
There's a legal gray zone for defense contractors. A law passed in 2000 allows for the prosecution of civilian defense contractors. Blackwater employees work for the Department of State. Jonathan Tracy is assistant director for the National Institute of Military Justice.
Blackwater, sure, is employed by the State Department, but they're performing a function that, in the end, is supporting the mission of the Department of Defense. And you know, I can't say which side of that argument would win, but that's what the argument is.
The Blackwater employees charged in the case are all ex-military personnel. Because of their military credentials, the law could apply to them. Again, Jonathan Tracy.
If somebody was in the military and they retired from service, but then they're serving in some capacity as a contractor and they commit a crime, they can be charged under this act for committing the crime that they committed while acting as a contractor if they were still receiving pay from their prior military service. So in other words, if they were retired and they were getting and they were entitled to retirement pay and they are alleged to have committed a crime, then this act could apply to them.
Blackwater, however, hides under the banner of the State Department. Blackwater says that incidents that happened in the Iraq shooting are possible under their working conditions. Here is Blackwater President Eric Prince being questioned at a congressional hearing last year by Representative Danny Davis, Democrat from Illinois.
You do admit that Blackwater personnel have shot and killed innocent civilians, don't you?
No, sir. I disagree with that. I think there's been times when guys are using defensive force to protect themselves, to protect the package they're trying to get away from danger. There could be ricochets. There are traffic accidents. Yes, this is war. Since 2005, we've conducted in excess of 16,000 missions in Iraq, and 195 incidences with weapons discharge. In that time, did a ricochet hurt or kill an innocent person? That's entirely possible. But again, we do not have the luxury of staying behind to do that terrorist crime scene investigation to figure out what happened.
Another case is currently being tried in Riverside, California, involving a retired military personnel under the same law. Sergeant Jose Nazario is accused of killing four Iraqi prisoners. Knowledge of his crimes did not come out until after he left the military. Gary Solis is professor of military law at Georgetown University. He says the history behind the act goes back to the Vietnam War.
Some soldiers were discharged before their crimes came to light. Formerly, it was not possible to court-martial an individual once he had been discharged. That is, once discharged and an individual became a civilian, the military had no way to bring him back to try him.
Solis says the War Crimes Act that Congress passed back in 1996 was a first step to clarify contractors' liability.
But for whatever reason, no one has ever been tried under the 1996 War Crimes Act. The Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, or MEJA, is a second effort to cure that gap in the law.
According to a recent Government Accountability Office report, a mere 58 cases involving contractors have been referred to the Department of Justice, and of that, 12 may go to federal court, a number some in Congress have said is far too few for the nearly 800 complaints against contractors the government report cited. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
With a new front of tensions developing between Russia and the United States in the Caucasus, New York State senators joined anti-war activists to announce a resolution to bring the state's National Guard home. They join eight other states in a resurgence of anti-war activism in a national campaign to press for the end of the occupation in Iraq and to stop future deployments by the National Guard. FSRN's Rebecca Miles reports from New York.
New York lawmakers will hold an emergency session tomorrow to decide how to cut $1 billion from the state budget. One item not addressed in the unchecked expense of the occupation of Iraq so far, exceeding $1.3 trillion, is how the deployment of the National Guard has increased the burden on states. Standing outside the U.S. Army Recruiting Center on Times Square on Sunday, New York Senators Bill Perkins and Eric Adams joined anti-war activists, members from Peace Action New York State, Iraq Veterans Against the War, and military families speak out to announce a resolution to demand the return of the National Guard. Many are still serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, and many on multiple combat tours. New York State Senator Bill Perkins said 6 years ago there was a drumbeat to go to war in Iraq.
The basis for that drumbeat for war began with the attack at the World Trade Center. The justification was that there were weapons of mass destruction, that Iraq was a danger to the United States. That justification is what authorized the use of military force. That was the AUMF that the president requires in order for him to federalize our National Guard. That justification no longer exists.
The 2002 AUMF, passed by Congress in response to the War Powers Act, put the National Guard on loan to the armed forces on a condition. The condition, as Perkins points out, no longer exists. The AUMF expired, and the continued use of the National Guard is illegal.
Many of them never expected, when they joined the National Guard, to be in Iraq, and they were never trained and psychologically and emotionally prepared for the kind of challenges that they met.
As a consequence of the deployments to Iraq, New York has had to find other people to do the National Guard's work, for example, hiring police for overtime. 65% of the National Guard equipment, such as trucks and utility vehicles sent to Iraq, will not be returning. And the prospect of escalating health costs for returning veterans is daunting. Military families speak out. Elaine Brower said the resolution should unite everyone.
You don't have to be for the war or against the war. If we had another major catastrophic event in this state or in other states, they would not be able to help. other states would have to combine their efforts and combine their resources. The budget of this state is in dire straits. And any money that has to go to equipment and to hiring more National Guardsmen comes out of our state budget. We are in a deficit.
At the event Sunday, a reporter asked why the senators were presenting a resolution instead of a bill. Senator Perkins added that it couldn't be a bill because it's out of their jurisdiction, because the authorization was federal.
So when you ask that question, ask Hillary, ask Chuck Schumer and the congressional delegation, because they authorized it. It's very, very important because some of them missed the boat on the Iraq war and now they regret it. Let's not compound that regret.
The resolution will be presented in the 2009 legislative session in January. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting from New York.
World Water Week began in Stockholm today, bringing together scientists, elected officials, and NGOs to tackle the growing global water crisis and develop water policy and management initiatives. This year, the conference is focusing on sanitation, health, and hygiene. More than 2.5 billion people lack adequate sanitation, affecting human and environmental health, according to the World Water Week website. And in many places, wastewater isn't being treated properly, leaving people with dirty water to drink and use for food crops. To examine the water crisis in detail, today FSRN takes you to Somalia, where water's been an issue since the central government collapsed with the fall of Siad Barre's government in 1991. In the long years since, pipes, reservoirs, and water treatment plants in south and central Somalia have been extensively vandalized. Mogadishu's residents have devised their own informal water distribution systems, but it may not be enough. FSRN's Abdurrahman Warsame reports.
The Bimalo neighborhood, one of the few remaining populated pockets in Holwudak district in the south of Mogadishu, is served by a well. All the public pipes have been looted, so the Bimalo well's owners have laid down its own pipes. Water is pumped from the well into huge elevated tanks, and gravity does the rest. Amina Mohammed's family of seven is one of the lucky ones in Bimalo who have a semblance of running water in their house. But she says the service is neither ideal nor regular.
The water runs between 8 in the morning and 1 in the afternoon. The water is untreated and really unsafe to drink. Sometimes the pump breaks down and we have to revert to donkey water, which is even less hygienic.
The donkey water she refers to is water from the same well, but delivered to households by donkey carts mounted with a 200-liter barrel, just enough to sustain an average Bimalo family of 8 for a day or two. Doctors say chronic diarrhea outbreaks in Mogadishu are among the adverse effects of the untreated water used by the city's residents. Khalid Jamal is the manager of Bimalo Well.
This well serves nearly 137 households with piped water. Four donkey carts take water to the rest of the neighborhood and beyond. Some families still depend on collecting water from the well in jerry cans.
Most wells in Mogadishu are owned by local business people who provide water to surrounding neighborhoods for profit. The price of the water in Mogadishu varies from one area to another. The bigger the neighborhood, the cheaper the water. The price often ranges from 17,000 Somali shillings for a 200-liter barrel to as much as 30,000 Somali shillings, roughly $1, a barrel far beyond the reach of most people. The price of water has more than doubled since the beginning of the year. Yusuf Ilmi remarks that water vendors explain the price increase in terms of the fuel price, but notice the price rarely goes down when the fuel becomes cheaper.
My family of eight used to rely on water fetched in 20-liter jerry cans on the heads of my wife and our daughters. But we started using donkey water since we live so far from the well. Our worst problem is not the purity of the water, but the very high cost because of the rising fuel prices. I spend a third of the family's budget on water, but it's still not enough.
Elmi's family gets by on 200 liters a day for the entire family's needs, for drinking, cooking, washing, everything. But he adds that there are relatively few donkey carts that serve the entire neighborhood, which makes it difficult to get water regularly. Usually, families have one regular donkey that serves them water once a day or once every other day. Each of the donkey drivers, who mostly own their donkeys, has dozens of households he serves. Drivers say they do not earn much, as the difference between the money they pay for a barrel of water and how much they sell is very small. Elmi said that when his family runs out, like many others in Bimalo, they turn to their luckier neighbors with running water. Bimalo's small-scale water system is replicated all over Mogadishu. For Free Speech Radio News and Enterprise Service, this is Abdurrahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News with Aura Bogado. FSRN has brought you uncensored news from the U.S. and around the world every weekday for more than 7 years. We're proud of our history of challenging old models of media access and control by highlighting the voices of marginalized communities most affected by social and economic policy changes. Now, a large funding cut and economic hard times jeopardize our ability to continue producing a daily newscast. You can visit us online at fsrn.org to find out more about how you can help keep us on the air. That's fsrn.org. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Today's headlines editor is Nell Abram. She's sitting in for Shannon Young. Our Washington Bureau Chief is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katapchi. Our interns are Robert Losa, Maciel Bobadilla, and Peter Steen. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.